You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to the Athletic Soccer Show. Today we're going to be doing a little bit of a deep dive into the top of the Bundesliga table. My name is Jack Collins and I'll be your host today. And I'm joined by the Athletic and TIFO Football's wonderful Seb Stafford-Bloor. Seb, how are you doing, mate?
I'm doing good, Jack. It's Friday afternoon. I'm doing exceptionally well. Can't wait for the weekend.
Indeed. Me neither. It's lovely to have you back on the show. And I'm looking forward to chopping up the Bundesliga and having a little look at what's going on at the top in Germany with you, Seb. Because we've got Bayern and Dortmund joint top of the Bundesliga on points, although Bayern's goal difference is aggressively superior. And in the last 10 years, there's only been one other time where Bayern haven't been clear at the top going into match week 23. That was 2018-2019, Niko Kovac's only full season in charge of Bayern Munich. And I think it's just been interesting to see, you know, at the start of this season, there were discussions going on around the Bundesliga and whether it's fallen off in terms of enjoyability because of Bayern's incredible dominance over the last decade. And suddenly we have a title race that you would argue is not just two teams, but actually Union Berlin behind them and RB Leipzig a point off that. Suddenly the Bundesliga is probably the most exciting title race in Europe, maybe the Eredivisie aside.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that, Jack. I think one of the problems is because of what's happened over the last decade, people can look at the Bundesliga table and see a title race and still not believe one's actually happening. So we're recording this on a Friday afternoon and a couple of hours ahead of Borussia Dortmund against Leipzig. And obviously that'll have an impact somewhere. And I think with each match day that approaches, you expect to fall back into the old pattern of, well, Bayern pull clear now. And they'll be in that situation where the Bundesliga is kind of wrapped up by spring and they're able to kind of focus their guns on the Champions League. Hasn't quite happened. And actually, what's really interesting about it is it's not as if throughout the season, all the chasing teams have been outstanding consistently. They've all had wobbles. They've all had moments, particularly Union Berlin just before the World Cup seemed to run out of steam a little bit. They just seemed very jaded and fatigued. Borussia Dortmund didn't start the season particularly well and seemed to take a while to settle into, you know, their new system and their new, new era under Edin Terzic, let's be fair. And it's only really since the beginning of the year that their consistency has moved up a notch. Leipzig too. Leipzig have sacked a manager. They got rid of Domenico Tedesco earlier in the season and they're on to a second coach, Marco Rosa. So you have all of these kind of imperfect sides, all a little bit flawed, and yet the narrative is still everybody has to be absolutely outstanding every single week, otherwise Bayern will slip away. So it's a very confusing time. You're not really sure what to make of it. Also, and I know we're going to talk about Bayern in more detail, it's really hard to know what Bayern Munich are. Really hard at the moment.
Yeah, I think this is it. And look, we're going to talk about each of them in turn. And I think we'll start with Bayern and then we'll move on to Borussia Dortmund and Union Berlin in turn. And I think this is it. Your point about the fact that there haven't been, you know, incredible amounts of competition throughout the season. Obviously, Freiburg were up in that conversation. They've fallen away a little bit. Union have been there or thereabouts most of the time. And Dortmund have kind of come from the mid-pack and caught up with this run in 2023. But I think the kicker for me is that you have to go back to 2011-2012 to find a Bayern side that had a lower points tally than this at this stage in the season, going into match week 23. That year, a very good Borussia Dortmund end up steaming to a title win by 8 points. And actually, that year, at this point in the season, I believe that Dortmund were 4 or 5 points clear of Bayern already. I don't think that this BVB side is as good as that one, but I think it's worth pointing out. And people will obviously point to Robert Lewandowski's departure in terms of what has affected Bayern Munich. But is it the only place that it's dropped off for Bayern this year? Because it doesn't feel like it.
No, I wouldn't say so. Also, one of the problems I have with the Lewandowski narrative, Jack, is that it degrades a little bit the contribution of Eric Choupo-Moting, who I think has played really well. Like, I think he's been, he's one of those guys who's been, who suffered a little bit from some unfortunate highlights in his past, but he has been a very good player. He's been a very good Bundesliga player for a very long time as well. He was at Schalke for a while before, obviously, Stoke City and Paris Saint-Germain. But there's a reason that a lot of really good coaches seem to like him. His finishing has been pretty good, and he's done a pretty decent job in what's been a difficult situation, not just because of Lewandowski leaving, but so Sadio Mane came in, and it's hard to overstate just how much of a high-profile signing that felt for Bayern Munich at the time and how hard they celebrated it and how it was presented in the press. But obviously, Mane was lost to injury before the World Cup, hasn't really, like, is yet to reemerge as the Sadio Mane we know. There have been a few issues with Leroy Sané and his levels of performance. He's always been a little bit of a streaky player. I think we know that. And has always been that way throughout his career. Then you look further back and at some of the sillier things, like, obviously, Manuel Neuer's skiing injury and the argument that resulted from the firing of Bayern Munich's goalkeeping coach, who was actually best man at Manuel Neuer's wedding. So in some senses, typical kind of FC Hollywood fare, right? It's what you would expect from a country where Bayern Munich are really the singular focus of the football media. It's not like in England where you have like four or five Bayern Munichs and attention is spread evenly. It is Bayern Munich and very little else on the pages of Bild or, you know, wherever else in the Kicker. And it's so you've got this kind of muddle of difficulties. There's been other nonsense around, like there at the beginning of the season, there was a little bit of disgruntlement over how Julian Nagelsmann was dressing on the sideline. So all in all, behind serious systemic structural issues, lack of consistent goal scoring, and that shows most of all in the fact that draws have really been the enemy for Bayern Munich. Yes, they've chucked in the occasional bad performance. Obviously, they lost to Augsburg. They lost to Mönchengladbach more recently. But they draw a lot of games, which you think and you're tempted to believe that had Lewandowski been in their side, probably wouldn't have happened. They'd have found that scruffy goal from inside, you know, between the goal line and the penalty box, penalty spot. Also, some question marks about the defense. I think it's fair to say that Dario Upamecano has been quite harshly treated since he arrived. I feel like he's been subjected to sort of a little bit more scrutiny because of his prior relationship with Nagelsmann and the kind of the over-focus on his decision-making, the occasional error he's made. Matthias de Ligt has, much as he did with his move to Juventus, clearly a really, really outstanding centre-back of the future. Is he an outstanding centre-half of today? I don't know. I think he's just very good. And so that's been that's been an area under construction. Benjamin Pavard's future is a little bit up in the air too. And I also think that it's gone under the radar since it happened, but I think David Alaba's departure hurt Bayern Munich in more ways than people really appreciated. He had a very flexible player. He had a very talented player. He contributed in so many ways. Also, and I apologize for the cliche, serial winner. Just knew how to win. And that's, look at the guy's mantelpiece, right? Beyond his attributes as a technical player, free kick ability, outstanding, really is outstanding as a center half, a fullback, a midfielder if you need, possibly a wide midfielder too. There aren't many players of that description in the world at any one time. And so this confluence of factors is very, very difficult to overcome. Even if you are Bayern Munich, even if you have these fantastic advantages, and even if your rivals aren't necessarily having the very best seasons.
Yeah, I also think, Seb, when you talk about these things, and I think this is really pertinent to the losses of both Alaba and Lewandowski, and then Neuer, as well as an injury loss, in that you're losing leadership. And it's thrown around as a cliche loads in that experience equals leadership. And I don't believe that those two things are necessarily true, although I think that there's a tendency towards more experienced players having good leadership abilities because they've got used to it. I think with Thomas Müller having a slightly indifferent season, shall we say, although he's been much better of late, there is this kind of sense that there's lots of people sort of umming and ahhing as to who the characters to step up in the big moments are for Bayern. And I think it kind of floats in because the goal scoring thing is one thing, but then you look at the Bundesliga table and and have scored 64 goals and have a goal difference of plus 43. You look at the squad statistics and there are five players over 10 goals in all competitions this season. Jamal Musiala, the aforementioned Choupo-Moting, Leroy Sané, Serge Gnabry and Sadio Mane all on 10 plus in all competitions. And I think it's important to note sometimes that this is what Nagelsmann wants. Like, this is actually what he's gone for. It's goals shared around was a major feature of his Leipzig teams.
Right.
And now he's getting it at Bayern Munich. And so there'll be plenty of pointing towards the Lewandowski absence. But I do wonder if Nagelsmann last summer went, yeah, I don't mind that. I don't mind that at all.
It's a very interesting situation to look back on because it felt... I mean, if I can kind of begin with the plug, Raph Honigstein wrote an excellent article about this in The Athletic at the beginning of the season when he was talking about how the lack of affection at Bayern Munich for Robert Lewandowski and how there had always been a slight distance there. Like, he wasn't necessarily a character for whom there was an awful lot of affection because he wasn't always the most personable guy. I think over time that changed and he kind of not redesigned himself, but restyled himself as a little bit of a kind of a more of a team player. I certainly think that that kind of bears out in the statistics. He became he became much more aware of the virtues of his teammates as his Bayern Munich career wound down. I think if you forgive me, you'll have to kind of, I'll have to guess at this, but I think if you look at his statistics from about 2018 onwards, you see a little bit more in terms of what he's able to give beyond just literal goal scoring. And at some point, that was going to have to change because, as we said about Alaba, how many Lewandowskis are there at any one time? And if you're Nagelsmann and you're being given the keys to something like Bayern Munich and your reputation is at least, because Nagelsmann is not a serial winner, he's not in that category. He's someone who had that to prove when he got to Bayern Munich. He is someone whose reputation is built on style, on ideology, on personality to an extent. It's an awful lot easier to make that kind of indelible impact if there isn't a Lewandowski that you have to go through to do that. That's not to say that he wanted Lewandowski out of the club. Not at all. I just mean that if you're to construct something in your own image, it becomes easier if the whole system is a little bit more pliable at that time. I think that, I mean, the difficulty of it still can't be overstated because how do you replicate that? Because, and again, it's a cliche, but how do you replicate the convenience of having such a gifted goal scorer? Like, how do you, not necessarily someone that's able to do the magical things that Sadio Mane is, who's the better footballer, Mane or Lewandowski? I would say Mane, in terms of his breadth, in terms of his contribution, in terms of his value in different areas of the pitch. But if you wanted that kind of blunt instrument, if you wanted someone who was able to convert the kind of chances that that Bayern Munich, with all its kind of territorial and possessional dominance, was attuned to create, Lewandowski is your guy, right? And so without him, you have to rebuild the whole thing in quite an extensive way. So no, I can see both sides of the coin, but it's funny, isn't it? Because one of the ironies of this season is that people say that the Bundesliga is boring because of Bayern Munich's dominance. The Bayern Munich situation is fascinating. It's really fascinating because you have a scenario potentially where I think they probably get through against PSG because I just don't think Paris Saint-Germain are capable of coming to Germany and winning. But at the same time, can you imagine if Bayern Munich from this position were to be knocked out by Paris Saint-Germain in the Champions League and not to retain the Bundesliga? It's very difficult territory for someone like Nagelsmann. Regardless of his reputation, regardless of his past, Wunderkind coach, all this kind of stuff, it doesn't really matter because you have to win. And so all of these things are having to be balanced alongside the fact that he's working on the brightest stage he's ever encountered. Like, coaching Hoffenheim and coaching RB Leipzig is not a preparation for working for Bayern Munich. It's just not. Like, it's so different. It's a completely different environment with a completely different level of scrutiny. And so it's actually very, very compelling theatre.
Yeah, I'd completely agree. I completely agree. And it's going to be a very interesting couple of weeks for Bayern and for Borussia Dortmund, I think, who we'll come on to next. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, you look at Bayern's second leg and then Borussia Dortmund's second leg, PSG and Chelsea, they both have an advantage. You'd make them both favourites to qualify. And then we'll have Champions League quarterfinals towards the end of March and a Clásica on the 1st of April. Now, it might be April Fool's Day, but that is very much no joke. And we're talking about the way that this season is working up and where things are getting to. And look, I'm going to make this clear because we're recording this pre the game between Leipzig and Dortmund tonight. And you know, as we record this, and if you're a Dortmund fan and this ends up cursing things, I am genuinely sorry because I think this is a fascinating, fascinating story and I long hope it continues. But Borussia Dortmund have had a 100% record in all competitions since returning from the World Cup break. They haven't dropped a point. They haven't drawn a game. They haven't lost a game. And this turnaround in form has been stunning because, you know, as we kind of alluded to at the start of the podcast, Seb, at points in the autumn, this looked like a season that might end up being frittered away for Borussia Dortmund. It looked like a season where it might be like, okay, we've built something. It hasn't quite clicked this season, but we'll get to next season and we'll know what to do with it. And suddenly that perspective has very much flipped on its head. And it's like, well, can we win the title? And right now you'd be hard pressed to say no.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I didn't expect to be saying this in the new year because throughout the autumn, I remember thinking that Dortmund just reminded me of who they were the previous season, which was under Rosa before he departed the club. They're a team who played in moments, right? They didn't seem to have a particularly solid system. They didn't seem particularly reliable. They just depended upon contributions from their key players, which is kind of fine when one of those key players is Erling Haaland. But obviously they came into this season with, and I would say last season, maybe Daniel Malen wasn't quite what the club had hoped for. There were problems in midfield. There were problems at centre half, which was behind the kind of the signings of Nico Schlotterbeck and Niklas Süle. But fast forward to the present day, and there have been a couple of things which have gone well. Like, there's more stability in their phases, definitely. I'm not entirely sure whether they're defending better because I'm absolutely certain that the goalkeeping has improved. Like, Kobel's been really, really excellent really in my good. Mind since the turn of the year. And I'm always wary of when you say those two things together, there's always a little bit of analytics somewhere which disproves it. So I would say that that's an area of improvement. But also, I feel like they have more players who can contribute in the same areas. There's a little bit more depth. So, for instance, obviously, Sebastian Haller has come back, and that's been a wonderful story. But I imagine a huge emotional lift to everyone. At the club, but also Adeyemi has emerged as a contributor, even though he's injured tonight. At the same time, like, you've got a player like Julian Brandt playing really well, and he can deputize on the right side of midfield if you need him to. One of the surprises of the season actually has been, I think Marius Wolf has played really well.
I was going to say,
and there really been times I hope this isn't really unkind. The times when I watched Marius Wolf in the past, I just thought, what are you doing there? Who signed you? Right? Who thought that you fit into this system? He's been like, it hasn't been great. That's not embellished, but he's been very consistent and some of his delivery has been very good. He's played well in key moments, which has allowed the club to build this recent record. And obviously Marco Reus coming back is important. One of the signings that I really like was Julian Ryerson, the Union Berlin fullback, is coming to play right back. They've got great depth there because obviously Süle can play right back. Ryerson can deputize. You can put Wolf in there as well, should you need to. And so all of a sudden, you have a Dortmund who are playing more cohesively, but also who can survive injuries, which wasn't the case before. Because prior to the World Cup, you lose Moukoko, problem. Lose Marco Reus, problem. Brandt, problem. And at the heart of all of this is one, he's truly a world-class player now, Jude Bellingham. Like, I went to the Revier Derby against Schalke back in the autumn. And the way that that crowd responds to him is quite something to watch because there's such a tangible affection between player and club now. And I know that's probably a short-term thing, so he might leave at some point. But he is in every sense a talisman now. And also, it's going to sound a little bit like a criticism of Bellingham, but I think in the past, especially last season during the kind of the year of kind of very bitty play, I think there was a compulsion Bellingham felt to try and do a bit too much in midfield. He tried to be everything all at once. And that's part of growing up, I think, he had to be
as well. The fact that when Dortmund weren't clicking, he felt like that because it was probably the case. I think is maybe the interesting bit. And I don't think you're criticizing here in this, but there were points where it was like, if Jude Bellingham isn't playing well, Dortmund aren't playing well. And that is it. That's the end of the story.
Yeah, 100%.
That no longer feels like the case, I don't think.
This is it. Like I think at times it was like watching someone trying to play a 6, 8 and a 10 at the same time. And you just can't do that no matter how talented you are. And I get it's a complicated situation, because if you're aware that you are your team's best and most influential player, which I think Bellingham probably is, I think I don't think that's particularly controversial to say it, then that level of responsibility is going to weigh on you a little bit. And now it feels like he's eased into his talent, for want of a better expression. And the difference is just a world-class performer who will be worth whatever Dortmund asks for him, I imagine, whatever that figure ultimately ends up being. But yeah, I mean, I hate to say this, but I still don't trust it entirely, because on the horizon is that Bayern Munich game. RB Leipzig is tonight. I happen to think Leipzig are a little bit more talented than Dortmund, even if they aren't above them in the table. And you just want to see how Dortmund survive a pressure, because since coming out of the World Cup break, it was a very long break, but also it felt like people had given up on Dortmund. Dortmund no longer a story. The only story around Dortmund for a while was the good news of Haller coming back, which is just wonderful, better than any kind of football you could ask for. But also what's happening with Bellingham, what's happening with the recruitment, is Rafa Guerrero going to extend his contract, Mukoko's contract, what's going on there as well. Now it's about the title. So let's see what happens when people have actually started talking about that happening, and it is a neck and neck race with Bayern Munich, because it's a different situation.
Yeah, and this is it. The pressure always mounts. I've always said, you know, about Arsenal this season, to pull a comparison, that you can be like, Arsenal are very much title challengers and they are currently in pole position, but I don't know if they can do it until they do it. And because we haven't seen it over the line with this side. And I think this is it. We've seen, obviously, Borussia Dortmund and Arsenal win titles before, but not with this crop. And not with, you know, this manager and everything that's going on around it. And so it's almost like, until Borussia Dortmund get themselves over the line, I don't think you can say with full assurance that you think Borussia Dortmund, or anyone can say that Borussia Dortmund are ready to win a title, because we don't know. But all the signs are good. And that's as much positivity as you can give, especially considering where they were, as you say, coming out of the World Cup break.
100%.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Let's move it on to the team in third, because this is one of Europe's great stories, Seb. I think Union Berlin, and you wrote a wonderful piece about Union following on from their 0-0 draw with Ajax in Amsterdam, a result that obviously ultimately helped them knock Ajax out of the Europa League. Their story is a wonderful one, and I just kind of wanted to give you the floor to express it in all its glorious detail, because there are loads of people out there who will be shocked by Union's ascent to the top of the table. But I do think it's one of those stories where the reality is almost more incredible than the perception that's held widely.
Yeah, it's a funny one, because first of all, let me point people in the direction of Kit Holden's book about Union Berlin, because nearly everything I've learned about their history comes from there. That was my sort of kicking off point. That's how I learned about them. And Kit's done a wonderful job in in telling the stories around their past, which a lot of people are familiar with. I mean, this is a club where the support, you know, over 2,000 supporters helped build their current stadium, where at one point in their history, to kind of stave off liquidation, supporters actually gave their blood to raise money for the club. It's a place where, for instance, you know, after reunification and the fall of the Berlin Wall, they found themselves in such financially dire straits that ticket sellers, so Union Berlin are based in a region of southeast Berlin called Köpenick, and the stadium is surrounded by a forest. And there was a point where they sold tickets in the forest so that the sellers collecting the money could disappear out of sight of bailiffs who were chasing the money for cash. This is the club's past. Also, what's very interesting about it is that it is a East German club, and it's the only East German club currently, well, the only authentically East German club in the Bundesliga. RB Leipzig is obviously a different case. And so what you have is a fan base which have, in some instances, grown up behind the wall, in some instances, born to people who grew up behind the wall, who grew up under a communist system, who in certain cases experienced oppression. But then at the same time, and one of the things I'm still learning about is this idea that we're all taught, and you'll be able to kind of, you'll recognize this. I think the kind of the story around the reunification of Germany is that the wall fell, everybody ran from East Germany into West and never wanted to go back. It's not really true. There's a lot of, we talk to people who actually grew up in East Germany. It's a lot of affection for, you know, certain aspects of society, and, you know, a lot of distaste for others, but it's a more nuanced tale than it's often presented as. And so in the present day, Union Berlin becomes this melting pot of different people with different perspectives, with different life experiences, who've lived under different conditions. They're not a left-wing club. That's a label I see quite often. That's not really a fair depiction of who they are. It's not really who they want to be either. People at the club will say they don't tell their supporters how to think or vote or believe. And, you know, the focus at Union is the football. And if you ever get a chance, listener, to go there, do. It's very, very difficult to get tickets, and it will be until they expand their stadium. But it's a remarkable place, and it's very English, actually, with the kind of the four sides of the ground, close to the pitch, hear the coaches in the technical area if you sit close enough. It's a proper atmosphere. But for them to be where they are today is ridiculous. Like, I've seen the kind of comparison with Leicester City. It's nothing like Leicester City. You know, Leicester City were bankrolled by a fabulously wealthy owner. And whilst Union Berlin have had the patronage at times of wealthy benefactors who've stepped in to help them, the budget on which they've done things is tiny in comparison. Also, you can actually go onto Transfermarkt and see this, if you see the turnover of player year to year, even now, even when they're in the Bundesliga, playing Europa League football, and they feel kind of safe in the assumption they'll be playing European football of one sort or another next season, I think the average stay for a player there is about 2.2 years, something like that, something 2.2, 2.3. And so at the heart of this, you have Urs Fischer creating new combinations out of nothing. They've got players there who are in the old Zweite Bundesliga, players like Christopher Trimmel or Nico Gieselmann, who no one would have ever thought you're going to be playing in the Bundesliga. And not only that, you're going to be knocking out Ajax for the Europa League. And you mentioned, I did go to those games. And I think what surprised me is that what surprised me across the two was that just how much better Union were than Ajax and how comfortable they were without the ball. And everybody knows that they play in a low block, and, you know, their focus is very much on congesting space in the center of the pitch and taking away the opportunity to create. You know, that's fine to say it. I don't know many teams that do it better or are able to go, for instance, to the Johan Cruyff Arena, sit off the ball and just be comfortable doing it and give away nothing. Union were immeasurably better than Ajax in that first game too. They should have won the match, and yeah, we're very unlucky to have a goal chalked off. But
I still can't see what the handball is. I've watched it maybe 100 times. I can't see the handball.
I know, right? Like, I was in the stadium, and I didn't have a replay of it at the time, and I saw it when I got back to my hotel that night, and it's terribly harsh. Like, that's the kind of handball you give if you want to find a reason to disallow something, I think. It was terrible, really, because it was an amazing moment for Morten Thursby. And there's this little pocket of Union fans up in the far left-hand corner from the press box who sat amongst all this flare smoke all night, and it just looked like they were sitting in fire or standing in fire the entire evening. And obviously when Thursby scored, they went crazy. And it was one of the, it was like watching, it's a little bit melodramatic to say history because, you know, in the context of world events and that kind of stuff, but it was an amazing footballing moment to witness this club that have come from nowhere. And I mean nowhere. And do read Kit Holden's book because it's absolutely fantastic. And it really creates the context of what's happened and what Urs Fischer has been able to do. They are, yeah, they're a great success story.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something you touched on there that maybe is the thing that impresses me most is that turnover and the fact that this isn't based in names or it's not based in bringing people in and who are going to suddenly be like, you know, there was obviously lots of rumors over the, you know, the course of things about who was going to join Union and what was going to happen next and all of these things. But you kind of look at it and you go, this is a 3-5-2 set in stone. And it has been for such a period that it feels like players are brought in to fit the system rather than the system is moved to fit the players. And I love that. I love the fact that Union in so many ways and for such a long period of time, and my friend Sam Tai says this a lot, are the only team who look like they know how to defend in the Bundesliga. And I do enjoy that as an idea. I think it's probably an exaggeration. I think it's a little bit melodramatic, but I like the idea that they're built and they're set up in a way that kind of the league doesn't like. It's almost like, okay, the Bundesliga is this mad transitional league that everybody loves galloping into space and having a great time. And it's what made the Bundesliga so fun for such a long period of time to watch. And Union are coming and be like, nah, absolutely no, we are not doing that. That doesn't suit us. And I love how stringent they've been with that. And just the fact that they have taken that model and ridden it right to the top of currently, you know, the league. And also, you've got to look at them right now as one of the Europa League favourites. Imagine saying that 5 years ago.
It's crazy. I also think like that system point is really valid because I think it helps players. I think it helps players when they come in. It's not a coincidence that, for instance, you see someone like Rani Kadira come in and all of a sudden he looks like one of the best defensive midfielders in Germany. That's just crazy. Or that you can, I think in three successive seasons prior to this one, Union sold their top scorer. And when you do that, when you lose a kind of dependency, you need to, well, it doesn't even need to be a forward. It needs to be, you know, any combination around the pitch. You need to construct chemistry really, really, really quickly. And if you're doing that, you bring in new players. Like you need to bring in a Jordan Pefok so that Geraldo Becker can, start playing the best football of his career. People need to have this idea of what their role is. And the midfield's a great example of that. Like Kadira Harborough has been otherworldly at times. Yeah. I think the goalkeeper is a very, very good player too. And that centre-back system has been shuffled a little bit. And yet the point you make about defending is like, I'll take it a little bit further. They are like, it is unusual to see a side defend that well in Germany, but it's also quite unusual to see a team play in such a consistent fashion and produce results which are so similar. Okay, the blemish ahead of the World Cup aside, what other team in Germany are able to pump out results like that throughout the course of the season compared to, you say, well, Gladbach, right? Who knows what Gladbach are? Because Gladbach are different every week. And Gladbach seem to adapt to whoever they're playing. And, you know, they can beat Bayern Munich, but then they'll get hammered by Mainz 2 weeks later. Yeah. Or Leverkusen, who at times you watch them and you think, yeah, this is going to work. And then not so much.
Leverkusen. They have a role in the game. And the role in the game is to just be the weirdest team on the planet. I love them deeply, but I sometimes I watch them and them losing the first leg against Monaco in the Europa League with a last minute goal from a centre back from 35 yards was the most Leverkusen thing I've ever seen happen until Leverkusen then went to Monaco and won on penalties. And I was like, well, that's it, isn't it? That's the club in a nutshell. 5-5 draw, 1 on penalties. Brilliant, great fun, having a great time. But no one knows what Leverkusen are going to turn up. You know every week what Union Berlin are going to turn up. And that's, I think, the key here, right?
I think this is the key virtue of Union, is that identity, not in the social sense, like the footballing sense, the football technical sense. What is your role as a player? What is your function as a component? I mean, their recruitment is really, really good. In a world where recruitment is always going to be around kind of 1 in 2, 50% chance of succeeding, theirs is a lot higher than that. And that's kind of, I mean, It's a, I mean, for instance, if you've watched the sort of Juranovic's performances since coming to the club from Celtic and replacing Julian Ryerson, it's like nobody left. I know that Juranovic is a really good player, and he showed that during the World Cup, and he showed that.
And at Celtic, to be fair, yeah.
But then, okay, so to draw a kind of a Premier League parallel, right, well, Pedro Porro looks like a really good player too. Not at Tottenham, he doesn't. This is the difference, okay? So you have like an expectation on what you're supposed to be and how much easier that probably makes it to be a footballer under Urs Fischer. And if you were to take, and this is going to sound really mean-spirited, and I don't mean it to be so, but if you were to take a lot of these players out of that system, I'm not entirely convinced they'd be as successful. Maybe with a few exceptions. I think Geraldo Becker is fabulous. I think he's a sort of really interesting, multifaceted player. He's worth tens of millions of euros now. But generally speaking, elsewhere, you've got a system and a mechanism that just works really, really well and gilds the reputation of everybody who takes part in it. And it's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, and to kind of drive it home, I think one of the players I really enjoyed watching kind of in the youth leagues was Diogo Leite, who played for Porto's system, and he looked like he was going to break through, and then it didn't quite happen for him at Porto, and they went off to Braga on loan, and in the first half of the season he looked okay, and in the second half of the season I think he got 5 starts in, you know, the entire second half of the season. Braga just decided that he wasn't trustworthy enough. And so his second loan spell, he goes off to Union and he looks like a world beater. And I'm like, that's the player I saw at youth level. That's him. Like, that is the exact bloke who was dominating teams in the UEFA Youth Leagues and who then went up into the senior teams and didn't look like that player anymore. And suddenly he's gone to Union, and maybe he's just grown into himself. But I think that this is a really good example of it, in that he's gone in there and he looks like he's playing the football of his life again. And I think so much of that is to do with Urs Fischer. He's getting the best out of his players. And that is a really, really impressive thing in a world where players are disposed of after a season where they're not playing well.
You're a Fulham fan. So one of the things that's interesting about this is, like, one of my core beliefs about centre-halves is the player matters, obviously, but it also matters who's protecting them, what's happening outside of them, and who's keeping goal behind them. And when those things are right, the level of performance tends to rise. So, for instance, if you look at Tim Ream this season, what's different? It's the same player to the one that was in the Premier League last time around, okay? But João Pelini is ahead of him, who has just been absolutely outstanding. I could watch him tackle players. I didn't even want to watch him play football. I just want to watch him tackle players. It's like watching like a woodsman going through a forest with a massive axe, just hacking stuff down. He's just fantastic. So, like, good player in front of him, a goalkeeper playing absolutely outstandingly well behind him. So you're kind of accentuating the opportunity for success. And Union is the ultimate example of that. You know what your role is. You know that everything is quite stable around you. You know that those wing backs are going to be where they're supposed to be, because that's the organization in that system is crazy. If you watch them and you watch how hard they work, like, because when you think of a low block, you think it's quite passive and docile, and, you know, it's going to sit there and bounce out of defense when you get the opportunity. Actually, the grind of it is quite something if you get the opportunity to watch it. Like, in Amsterdam, for instance, like, the press box there is so high that it's like your own little tactical camera that you don't really necessarily get the opportunity to have in, like, English grounds, for instance. And there's this kind of interesting codependency. There's so much trust in that team that if you're a centre back, it must be like dying and going to heaven. You know, it's an ideal world to rebuild your reputation. That's a great example because, you know, like, he was a difference maker against Ajax in both boxes. You know, so he scored the goal from the corner, but also defended ever so well throughout. Just another success story that, you know, among about a dozen others.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to finish, Seb, you mentioned Tim Ream there, but I wanted to touch very briefly on a couple of other USMNT internationals. One at Union, who you mentioned, Jordan Pefok, and then Gio Reyna at Borussia Dortmund. I would say that they're both slightly out of favour in terms of being first 11 selections, but both feel like they're still very important within the mechanisms of a squad. And perhaps that's quite a nice place to be at two teams that are doing really, really well. Obviously, Jordan started the season as very much first choice partnership with Geraldo Becker. He's been kind of usurped by Behrens in the last couple of weeks.
He's played really well.
As a starter, who has played really well. And that's fine. And Gio Reyna has kind of become Edin Terzic's super sub, which was quite a nice role for him after the kind of drama of the World Cup, him coming on, scoring a couple of really important goals, coming on, making a difference in late in games in this Borussia Dortmund team. It just feels like they're two players who might not be starting every week, and people will look at that and go, oh, that's not good, but actually feel still relatively important within the team.
Yeah, I suppose Jordan first. Like Jordan, to me, is never going to be a goal scorer, not at least not in the prolific sense. I see his role as being a kind of a defensive forward, but also a reference point for Geraldo Becker. If you go through Geraldo Becker's goals and you note the kind of the ones that sort of depend on a little interaction with Jordan, it's interesting to see kind of how aware of Becker's positioning he is and what role he plays. He's a very smart player, but also he's really tactically disciplined. And I suspect this is why maybe Behrens has taken his place recently, is that that is a hard... That forward role in that system is hard work. It looks it, at least to me, in my as a 30-year-old out of fit man. to me, one of the most impressive things about Jordan is the fact that he plays a role in making sure that like the passing routes into the center of midfield just don't exist. It's really hard to attack Union through the middle, and that's because of what he does. Whereas I suppose Becker's role is more as a channel threat on either side. Like you want him attacking a fullback or running to space. Jordan has an awful lot of responsibility, as does Kevin Behrens at the moment. So it's kind of like and I mean this in a complimentary sense, they're sort of interchangeable. The different set of players, sure. Jordan is a bit, I'd say, is a better technical footballer and is also sort of a more of a physical threat just because he's 6'5". I stood in front of him in the mix zone. He blocks out the sun. He's absolutely huge. But he's also like, I don't know, he just looks a bit jaded, I think. I don't know. I mean, it's speculation, but I just wonder sort of whether it was quite dispiriting to miss out on the World Cup. I was very surprised by that. I just thought that as an England fan, delighted not to see him play against England because he's very, very difficult to defend against, even if that doesn't always translate to goals. But you'll see him make a contribution before long. He'll be back at some point. I imagine... he seems to be very popular. He scored the last goal he scored was against Mainz. It was a winner at home to Mainz. And I think the way that his teammates celebrated it, the goal after seeing him sort of go 4 months without scoring said quite a lot about, how he's appreciated within that team. I think that the previous goal was against Wolfsburg, his little diving header at the near post back in September. So he went a really long way without scoring. And that must have been very, very difficult. Reyna's a little bit of a different issue because I have no perspective on the stuff in capital letters that happened after the World Cup. I don't know enough about it really, or where it came from. But if you look at it from the player's perspective, I think that's got to be super difficult. Like anytime your parents become prominent in your life like that, I don't think that's easy. I imagine it wouldn't be at that, in such a visible way. And you're quite right. Like when he came back, he had three consecutive substitute appearances where he scored. Two of those were winners. That helped change the story around him. The thing is that he's been one of Dortmund's most effective players in that regard, but he's barely played. I think if you added up all of his minutes since the restart, the end of the winter pause, I'm not sure it even adds up to 100 minutes, 110. I might be wrong in that, but it's very, very few. And I got sympathy because... We began the podcast by talking about the depth that Dortmund have in these key positions. So you'd probably use Reyna either as a central base attacking midfielder or as a right base player. So he's competing for a place in those positions with Marco Reus, Julian Brandt, Karim Adeyemi, potentially Maris Wolf, resurgent Maris Wolf. You could theoretically shift Marlin out there. I know he's a left-sided player, but you could do. You've got an awful lot of talent that you have to get through to get playing minutes in this Dortmund team. It's extremely difficult. It feels like he's in a little bit of a catch-22 because I still think there's a little bit of not fitness, but sharpness missing from his game. I think I think he's an example of someone who, if you were to play 38 games a season, you would see that kind of exponential growth that sometimes happens when a player truly settles and learns that his place in the team isn't threatened by his every touch. Like when a player's on the bubble like that, every pass matters, every cross matters, every miscontrol matters. When a player knows they're a little bit more secure in the team in a sort of, in sort of the Jude Bellingham way, their levels of expression and their confidence and their kind of security in their own game rises, as almost certainly does their kind of, you know, their effect on matches. And he's just not quite in the right situation at the moment. I don't know why that is. I'm not going to pretend to, but not a wonderful player to have off the bench though, right? What a luxury. And not the kind of player that you'd expect a Borussia Dortmund to have necessarily in that situation as a kind of a third choice attacking midfielder, fourth choice attacking midfielder. That's great depth.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because obviously Dortmund shift their system around a little bit. Sometimes you see three centre midfielders with Can, Bellingham and Sally Özcan, who we didn't even mention, but I absolutely love.
Which is strange because he's been great. It's so strange. This is the Dortmund thing, right? Because you miss players now, which is a really healthy sign.
Yeah, it is. But you're right, in terms of Julian Brandt is on one of those streaks, and he's been a streaky player for his whole career, but he feels like he's on a longer streak than usual this time in terms of being excellent. Marco Reus is club captain and very much the kind of emotional heartbeat of the team. It's hard to get in ahead of those players. And so to sit around on it, and you know, obviously it must be hard to watch, obviously on the other side, Jamie Bynoe-Gittens has started to kind of make his way, who's a little bit younger. And you're like, it must be hard for Gio Reyna to watch that and be like, oh, hang on. And it just happens to be that the left-hand side is probably slightly weaker than the right. And therefore, Jamie Bynoe-Gittens is getting a little bit more joy in terms of minutes and getting a little bit more of a rub of the green at that point. But I think it will come for Gio Reyna. And as you say, if he keeps being effective off the bench, eventually the opportunities will start to rear their head more regularly. I think he's just got to get his head down and work at the moment. And I imagine that will be a bit of a relief in some ways to just get your head down and work with all the things swirling around him.
Not to be the conversation for a bit, I think would really help him. Like I don't have an oversight of his World Cup situation. I've only heard the kind of the stories that have come out of it, but that didn't sound great. Also, like the problem with someone like Bynoe-Gittens, I think Bynoe-Gittens is a little bit of an explosive player. Like he's got that sort of, he's got that combination of, you know, electric speed, but also like the technical ability that allows him to kind of, you know, to penetrate like congested areas. And that is a real virtue in this system. It feels like from the left-hand side, at least, that's a kind of real virtue. And Bynoe-Gittens has played well since he came back from injury. Like he's played very few minutes, but his contributions have been good. And so it's very, very difficult to kind of, to place him on the other side too. Also, Daniel Marlin has been better this season. And so he's been a kind of a quiet performer too. And it's really difficult, really, really difficult.
But really good, I imagine, if you are a Borussia Dortmund fan. And with that, I think we are going to call it a day here on The Athletic Soccer Show. And all that's left for me to do is say thank you so much to the wonderful Seb Stafford-Bloor for all his contributions today. Seb, it's been a real pleasure having you back on.
You're most welcome, Jack. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. I've been Jack Collins. This has been The Athletic Soccer Show. We hope you've enjoyed today's Bundesliga rundown. We'll be back with another big talking point next week. Take it easy, gang.